a small patio where the owners would go for swims in the summer. It's considered in that utilitarian way as well of being able to use it, but it respects the river in an aesthetic way as well. It lets it be there, and it doesn't try to overpower it in terms of, you know, it doesn't try to capture it behind any kind of glass or anything. It just lets it flow. And in that way, the building, it has its, and maybe this is why I admire Wright's buildings a little bit more than Le Corbusier. It has there's a sort of productive tension in here. It has its own presence, and yet it finds itself subtly allowing the surrounding nature to exemplify its presence.
Yeah, so I just want to, you know, kind of jump on a little bit what you're saying, because I completely agree. First of all, I want to say Wright over Le Corbusier, like, every time. Right? I mean, like, Frank Lloyd Wright is perhaps the most famous North American architect of all time. And I think there's good reason for that, because, like, just looking through his homes, they are, every single one is extremely, there's some really key differences, actually, that we can talk about more, which is, compared with Le Corbusier, many of his structures look very similar. Whereas Wright's, obviously, they clearly flow from the same hand, but they are all very unique. And I think that that's basically a byproduct of this different perspective, at least very different modernist perspectives we're seeing, right? Le Corbusier, especially with Le Domino or The Domino, is a perfect example of, like, this is, like, a mass-producible structure that you can place, as long as you've got some flat, relatively stable ground, you could, in theory, put this anywhere. And you can arrange it how you want, but, like, the skeleton will always be the exact same. Whereas with Wright, you're obviously seeing homes that are very much designed for specific places, right? And I think I remember watching some interviews with Wright and stuff like that, where he would very much, like, on most cases, if he's been, you know, hired or contracted to build a home, he would, you know, travel to that space, or at the very least ask for detailed photographs of the surrounding area, so that he could get a sense of, like, okay, like, what are we working with here? Not just, like, how much space do we have, but literally what is around. And it's interesting, because we're talking a lot about Wright's modernism, which has always kind of been there, but it's really interesting to see some of his, like, modernist homes, like, from the late 19th and very early 20th century, which still, I would say, have very classical craftsman styles to them. Frankly, a lot of, like, the older homes that you see in places like Vancouver, which is a lot of wood, shingling, stuff like stained glass and all that kind of stuff. But even, like, I'm actually looking at an image. People can go look it up if they want to. It's Wright's home in Oak Park, Illinois. It was constructed in 1889, so quite a bit before the real modernist movements were starting to take off. And, you know, it's a home which is very clearly still, like, traditional in a lot of ways, but has a lot of exaggerated and organic features, right? There's a lot of sort of curvature, swooping lines. The, like, gable of the home, the actual, like, A-frame structure of the roof, is quite a bit wider than you'd normally see. And what's interesting is, when you look at the house, you can kind of tell that around the home there are very large trees which have, like, almost a similar angle but in reverse. So rather than, obviously, the angle of the triangle getting wider as it comes closer to the earth, it's as if the angle of the triangle of the tree as it spreads out is, you know, getting wider towards the sky. But even in this, like, very simple images that I'm looking at online, you can see how there's this sort of reflection and discussion going on with, like, very obvious surroundings of this home. And this is a home that's, like, quite a bit before the much more classically looking modernist structures like Falling Water that you see in, like, the kind of 30s to 50s era.
The thing that strikes me about this is, so this is a residency. It has lots of parts to it still. It still looks like a complex whole. And I think that's what Wright does really well in Falling Water, but in other works as well, is that he is, since he has multiple parts, he's able to arrange things. You can't, like, how do you arrange a domino? How do you arrange the Villa Savoy? I mean, with the 5 points of architecture, okay, you got to hit on your flat roof, you got to get your horizontal windows, you got to have the Pilates, sure. But there's no real way to, like, arrange that. Whereas here, when we're looking at this it's kind of exaggerated gable, it sits a little off-center in the building, but then you also have this kind of colonnade at the center of it. And I'm noticing this, how many is that? That's a hexagon. There's these, like, two hexagonal portions of the building that exist on either side, one larger than the other, one bearing the window and the other just being kind of a facade. So, like, Wright is working in a tradition that still sees architecture as working with complex wholes. And so he's able to, in that, I think, incorporate not just the elements of the building itself, but the elements that surround it as well. I like that you bring in the trees and specifically the sort of inversion or the inverse relationship between the gable and the trees here, because that's a consideration that Wright is making internal to the building, but also in consideration to the external surrounding sort of circumstances that the building finds itself. And it also is going to vary over time. I mean, several of these photos, the trees look different at different times. The grass at the or some of the bushes look different at certain times. So he's considering that variability. The other thing I notice about the Frank Lloyd Wright residence is that it's quite dark. A lot of the there's high points of brightness in the brickwork, but it's a pretty subdued residence, actually. You get reflections from the windows, but it doesn't try to stand out like a lot of Le Corbusier's work. I mean, maybe because this is an earlier work, maybe Wright hasn't mastered the art of being a subdued urban designer yet. I mean, if we look at some of his other urban designs, they can be quite, not shocking, but some people thought that there was a gallery that Wright designed that people were quite surprised by. Apparently some people call it a...
You're talking about the Museum of Modern Art in New York. It's a very famous building.
It's quite standoffish in that way. It's quite daring. But Le Corbusier would not have, even in a basic residency like the Villa Savoy, there would have been no holds barred. Nothing, he would have held nothing back.
You see, though, I think you see in Wright, though, you see like a kind of tension, quite an interesting guy. But he also said, mechanization best serves mediocrity. And what you see with Wright in comparison to, say, someone like Le Corbusier with modernism is there is a kind of tension in Wright that I would almost describe or like displays itself as a kind of impracticability. You know, Le Corbusier, for all his faults, was definitely thinking about spaces that were mass producible for many people. And, you know, look at I think the domino is actually, again, coming back to this, is a great example of this, because at the end of the day, that general floor plan idea of basically just having concrete pillars supporting floors that are like open floor plans is effectively how we design and think about a lot of public buildings, whether they be office buildings, residential buildings. It is, in its own way, it is quite efficient, it is quite effective, and it allows for a lot of flexibility, and it's really easy to do and replicate. When you go to Wright, you see someone who builds buildings that are very specific to very specific people and very specific spaces and are not easily replicatable. And there's this kind of like tension that you see in modernism too with Wright, where it's like, well, is this something that's really modern then? Like how obviously there are modern inspirations, but like we're almost like circling back to a kind of like craftsman home ship. There's to use a famous example of this, there is a building in California, I can't remember the name of it right now, by Wright, is very famous because it took really clear inspiration from like Aztec style. and its whole surface is covered in these like concrete mosaic stones with these weird intricate patterns. The actual house was used, or at least inspired, I think it might even be used to film parts of Blade Runner, the film, but it's really got that kind of vibe to it. It's a very neat home. It would be incredibly expensive to build and complicated and require a huge amount of expertise. And it's, you kind of look at it and you're like, yeah, this is cool, but like, this is something that's really only achievable for a very small number of people. And that was the reality with rights structures in general, was, especially as it got a little bit later on, they were really only homes for the rich, effectively, because that's the only people that could afford to build such specified, custom, complex homes. And so I do think there's that tension there within Wright's own modernism, where it's like, well, we're almost going back to a weird sort of like modern aristocratic craftsmanship, where we're, you know, it's in the same sort of idea that we talked about in the last episode, where you had, you know, a lot of the burgeoning of like modern architecture and steps away from classicism were effectively aristocrats who were like, I want to build a Gothic castle as a house in like the 19th century, right? And they're the only people that ever think about that, because they're the only people that would have the money, the land, and could hire the like really specific artisans to be able to do something like that.
Yeah, that's a good parallel to draw. And it is a good question to ask. I mean, there's no doubt that Wright is kind of, he's drawing on the modernist vocabulary. Like if you look at Falling Water, obviously this is a modernist building. It's quite all over the place. And it uses that signature kind of square plastered look. But at the same time, I think you're absolutely right, is the ethos modern, because it's built for a particular person and it doesn't really respond to the needs of mechanization. It's a, you know, it's a summer home. It's a, you know, so that is a good question. I mean, I'm thinking of that portion of the interview where the interviewee is, so Wright says, you know, I could change America if we just leveled all the buildings and rebuilt them. That actually kind of sounds, you know, Cartesian, Corbusierian, if that's a word, you know, if we just level everything and then rebuild it all anew, then it'll all be good. But Wright says it in a very different way than Descartes and Le Corbusier. He doesn't think that, well, we just need to implement this plan and make it super uniform. He says, no, like, we have to build to suit unique individuals. Everywhere that there is a person, there should be a particular home for this person. You know, it's not their job to build their homes. It's my job to build their homes. I'm the architect. I know how to build buildings for these particular people. And it does have that problem of practicability that modernism does aspire to. I mean, and it is a good ideal. I mean, we want things that we can get to people that will improve their lives. And Le Corbusier arguably probably successfully did that, building the domino, even having principles of architecture that could be practiced kind of universally. The domino is, it's a material contribution to trying to make housing accessible to a large number of people. And we do think that that is a good ideal, to be able to get people the things they need and give them their material needs. Now, Wright is responding to some need that is a bit different, because in that quote, he is responding to a kind of malnutrition or a malnourishment of architecture, that, you know, we just kind of pump these things out, or they don't have any plan and they aren't really doing what they're supposed to be doing. So maybe that is a good criticism that, well, right, maybe, yes, architecture does need to aspire to higher ideals or higher things. But at the same time, people do like kind of need buildings to live in. Having a house is a good thing to have, even if it's ugly, or even if it's just like, you know, thrown together or kind of cookie cutter. People need a roof over their head. Le Corbusier does that at the cost of a kind of evaluative, or we might even say like spiritual kind of cost. You know, the building doesn't really suit me, or it doesn't really consider, you know, it doesn't give me what Wright could give me if he built my house. But yeah, I'm trying to think more what to say on that. Because that is it's a really good point. It's a really productive tension to bring up in this conversation. Yeah.
I think it really comes down to a sort of, you know, looking into Le Corbusier a little more, like there's a certain degree of like populism going on with him, it sounds like, from like very cursory readings. You know, there was criticisms at the time, and especially afterwards, that he was, you know, had some links to, you know, 1920s, 1930s political movements in the area, obviously fascism and that kind of thing. And those sort of very like modernist populist sort of movements that were very focused on, you know, providing something for like the people, for everyone, versus Wright. Now, from an interview with Wright, I remember him saying, you know, this was when he was quite old, not long before his death, but, or maybe it was a bit before, but he was quite old during this interview. And he said, you know, give me, it was either 10 or 20 years and I'll remake all of America. He famously said, now it's quite an arrogant quote, but I get where he's coming from. But also too, it's like, you know, as a lay person, even I look and I say, well, that would be nice, but like how many Frank Lloyd Wrights do we have? Like 100, 500, 1,000, like, each piece takes so much time and effort and, you know, and thought. And again, not a lot of thought is given to just pure practicality and repeatability, like more you see in Le Corbusier and those more populist modernist movements, where simplicity is really emphasized because, one, it's viewed as a virtue of this sort of scientific mindset. They almost, like, a lot of these buildings, I always think they kind of almost have like a laboratory look to them. Like if they were laboratories for some like secret or organization or something like that, like it's exactly, you could see them like in a movie, you know? But that's that kind of very plain, simple, replicatable, but like very interesting look nonetheless. Is far more like in turn with the view that kind of scientific virtue, but also the sort of populist virtue of like communal accessibility. Right. That these are like our buildings for us, like the nation, our community, whatever that might be. Whereas again, we're coming back to it, Wright is far more individualistic and far more centered in a particular space with particular people, particular natural background and environment. I mean, Falling Water is like the home, which is in an incredible piece of architecture, is a great example of this because it's literally built around a waterfall. Like it's a house that's literally built over and around, effectively designed into a hillside and waterfall. Like these are not homes that you could just place anywhere. It would try and move it somewhere and it'll fall apart. And so, you know, it's a very interesting tension between the two. And it's a real, like, you know, I think that you hit on something really early in the discussion as we sort of think about these two persons, not just as designers, not just as architects, but also as thinkers, where Le Corbusier is very centered in at least where the areas we're focusing on him, maybe we're not giving enough due credit for later designs, but let's just go with what we're mm-hmm. focused on so far. Very centered in this sort of populist, mass-produced, technical first half of the 20th century, especially 19-teens, basically the interwar period being the kind of height of his design era. And there's a real focus on generalizing the human being, generalizing the person in that era, right? Seen obviously most extremely in various political movements, whether that be in the, you know, sort of Stalinist era to obviously things like fascism and such, but this very generalized idea, the sort of populist movement, whereas Wright and what we're known from too more is almost like, I think maybe in some ways we, or at least prior generations, have more affinity to him. There is a strong individualistic aspect to his design philosophy. And it really is thinking about the home less as a thing for us, right? Like, we're going to say, how can we build the best space for people, the best machine for living, mm-hmm. right? And obviously this machine for living, it's not a machine for living for Tom. It's not a machine for living for Linda. It's a machine for living for people. Yeah. Whereas obviously Wright is taking this a completely different direction, saying I'm building a home, like space, like good homes are spaces specifically for a person, a individual, someone who lives there. And they were designed, you know, I remember watching an interview and a home tour walkthrough of a much lesser known Wright home. But, you know, the home, the individual who was giving the tour was the child of the original owners who designed the home effectively with Wright, as he would do, right? And they lived there their whole life afterwards. And that was kind of the idea. It was their space made for them, with them in mind, and not just anyone from a specific community. But that's really stepping away, in a way that's kind of stepping away and almost stepping ahead of that modernist tradition into a more individualistic, personal character-oriented outlook that you really start to see come up more in the kind of 1960s, 1970s, 1980s. That's very, you know, specific and tailored to individuals.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because like I'm thinking too about Wright's idea that because he's situated in an American context, and so it would make sense for Wright to be kind of individualistic, because America has always held the sovereignty of the individual to be, I guess, of value or important. And he's seeing American values not reflected in architecture when he is trying to bring the individual back to architecture. He sees it as a move back to what architecture, not just architecture should be, but what architecture for America should be, an environment where people can feel like they can be individuals and they don't have to just sort of accept what is around them. He sees it, his buildings, as enabling individuals to be who they are. So in a certain way, I do think that he is, like, yes, he is obviously individualistic in his architecture, not only from just the fact that he builds his buildings with the residents. I mean, that's about as individualistic as it gets. But this notion, there is a kind of way that he slips into, I don't want to say like, because I'm trying to like bridge the distinction between them a little bit and say that Wright does have an individualism to him, but he is doing this all in the service of others. So yes, while maybe the access to that is bracketed to certain classes of people who exist in this individualistic society, he still wants to cultivate a kind of ethos or national spirit through enabling others to be kind of who they are. And he thinks that, you know, if people would just do this, and, you know, if people were enabled to maybe even design their own homes or something like that, they might do this as well. And I think Le Corbusier does have Le Corbusier does have a small streak of individualism in him as well, not just because he's a modernist, and so he does believe in this general human spirit. It doesn't just exist in the abstract. I mean, he wants to construct these buildings because he wants to give each human the material conditions for realizing their own particular individuality. I mean, he puts the family in the Villa Savoy, not because he's just he's been given free rein to construct whatever building he wants. He thinks that this actualizes something real in a human being. Now, maybe he does this at a certain level of generality, but he does kind of like construct the same buildings, you know, we see with the domino. It's a certain belief that if a person is given the conditions, they can remake themselves. I mean, so the name Le Corbusier is not, I mean, that's a name he gave himself. And it was apparently a trend in France at the time to give yourself a single name like this in the spirit of a kind of rebirth. Le Corbusier is the kind of first, well, he's not the first, but when we think of, you know, an architect, the auteur, you know, the artist who builds buildings. We think of modernists who are constructing, you know, their masterpieces, or it's a kind of expressionism. Le Corbusier really is the pinnacle of that individualistic architect. So maybe while Le Corbusier is building buildings that are quite cookie cutter and are designed for the people in general, we see with Le Corbusier individualism in the form of the architect himself in a certain way. We see a particular vision of how to go about realizing humans, you know, modern potentials. I'm really glad that we found some tensions, because I came into this understanding that there were tensions. I feel like we now have not just a criticism of right, and maybe that's good because we're doing a bit of demystifying in a certain way, which is always nice. They do have something in common in that sense, and that is that strain of modern thought running throughout their architecture.
It's been really interesting to kind of delve into both of these architects and, frankly, thinkers, and see how they kind of accord with each other, but then clearly how they step away from each other, but also to constantly kind of reflecting back similar themes just from different perspectives. So I want to thank all our listeners for today. This has been the Canadian Philosophy Show, and we'll see you next week.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Sleep.